The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Pete gets into theft and bribery. Ron goes from circuits to bits to everywhere. Holiday cyber comedy comes to the fore. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
So we have Puck Fernston on the line here today. Hello, Puck. How you doing?
Great, Fred. Thanks for having me on. Excited to join you today.
Sure. So you've been extremely helpful in lots of ways, very friendly, very supportive of others who are, trying to start their companies and get them working. But what we don't know is about your company. So why don't you just start by telling us what's the name of your company and what are you trying to do?
Thanks, and always happy to be helpful, Fred. We'll have a long-term relationship. So my company is Guru, and Guru Global is the company where basically our first product is we're putting mirrors, safe anti-glare convex mirrors that go on the front of forward-facing baby strollers, so that parents and children stay connected during the most critical periods for brain development for the kids. So we've been working on this for many years, many prototypes.
Right, so hang on. Let's not rush ahead here. How do you spell Guru and what's the website?
G-O-O-R-U. And the website is GOORUglobal.com.
There you go. So Guru Global. And you have, a patent at least, or these sorts of intellectual property surrounding the mirror so a baby can see whoever's strolling them while they're strolling. And, of course, the person strolling them can see them. So now they can look at each other. All right. So first question, distracted strolling. So what happens when the parent's looking at the baby instead of the street and ends up getting in front of a car with the stroller?
Great question. So, for example, we've got mirrors in our cars. And when parents look at the mirror to see the baby in the back, it's great, but they're taking their eyes off the road. When somebody's pushing a forward-facing stroller, they can see both the mirror and what's in front of them at the same time, as can the child. So the child who loves seeing their parent or their caretaker in the mirror will look at the mirror, and they'll also see the world in front of them at the same time. And so they can do two things at once.
All right, so we don't need some high-level cyber automation to detect the presence of potential interferences to warn the strolling person that they're going to hit something, right?
No, thankfully not.
Okay. So now, how did you develop this mirror? Is this a complex analytical process to develop the mirror, or did you try like 500 different things?
Oh, this was such a bear of a process. When I first started prototyping, I was like, oh, there's no mirrors on strollers. Well, it's America. I'm going to go build one. Little did I know it would lead me down this road of 5 years of prototyping with lots of different engineers and lots of different capacities with lots of different industry partners to try to get something that would work universally with all the forward-facing strollers. And so it was not a process that was easy. It wasn't short. It was expensive and long. And it's one that I had to just keep sticking with it to try to get something that worked. And so we finally got an MVP done. And now we're at the process where we're just completing MVP being minimal viable product. Now we have just completed a DFM, which is design for manufacturing, to get the cost of that product down so that we could distribute it and make a profit when it gets put on all the forward-facing strollers.
So are you using now design automation tools to help make this, get all the designs and drafts out, or is this all a manual process with people drawing things?
The team that I have now is a really advanced technical team called Incata, and they use some of the latest technologies to help design and manufacture batches for people looking for hardware batches of products.
So there's a whole analytical process, design process that's all cyberized. And then presumably you push those design specs out to manufacturers to make it, right?
Correct. Because once we get the design specs, we have to then get it quoted to see who can make it for the highest quality and the least price.
So did you, 3D print the models of these, or how did you do the models?
Some of the components are printed. Some of the components are in the market, and we buy them off the shelf.
When you talk about fitting all strollers, this seems like it's crazy that, just a screw, what you use to attach things to other things seems like it would work, but apparently not.
Yep, that's what I thought, Fred. I thought we'll get a chip clip. No, so many different designs didn't work because some of the strollers are round, some are oval, some are square, some are flat. Those bars that put the stroller together, they're all different. And so getting a clamp that would work, stay on there solid, so a baby can't kick it off or it won't fall off on its own, that took a lot of thinking and a lot of trial and error.
So how about, is the mirror made of glass or out of some other material?
So the mirror itself it's a special mirror that is anti-glare technology. Why do we have anti-glare technology on it? It's because we needed the sun not to hit the kid in the face. Because you have a convex mirror, regular mirror, it'll come right off the mirror and into the kid. And we knew if we burned or blinded one baby, the whole game's over. All the good about face-to-face communication wouldn't matter. So the mirror is a specialized convex mirror. I can't go into the details of what we've done to create the mirror, but it's a large mirror where you can see hand signals. You can see facial looks, smiles, everything that you'd want to see in clear detail. For that child looking at the parent or the caregiver behind them.
Can we get the same mirror for cars? You have a patent on this, right? Or patent pending?
Yes, I've got a utility patent adding mirrors and technology to baby strollers, charging technology, Bluetooth technologies, so people can utilize their phones. That's a combination utility patent. And right now we're in the final stages of getting a utility patent just on the addition and integration of mirrors into forward-facing strollers.
Can the same technology, is it sufficiently novel that you could use it for other purposes?
Well, yes. It can be used for attaching to cribs. It can be used. I have one in my house that attaches so I can see around the corner when I'm in one room and the kids are in another room and I can see what's happening if I want to see. It's that universal attaching mechanism can be used on boats. It can be used on anywhere to attach this mirror. And then that anti-glare component of the mirror, which is also novel, that is going to be useful in more than just not burning babies.
Right now, you're trying to raise money for the manufacturing process to be able to push this out in volume?
Yes. And so the initial raise is to start manufacturing it and pushing it out.
I believe we have your GWiz online, and we'll make sure we get it up to date. But so people can look at the cybershow.co and look at your GWiz and get the details and get in touch with you. If they're accredited investors, just tell us very briefly about, I guess you're largely on the East Coast, but you come West every once in a while. What are you doing to go, find money for this? How much of an effort is it? And how many other people are you helping along the way?
I'm pretty heavily involved in the Boston startup community as a mentor for Techstars, as a judge for Mass Challenge, a top accelerator. Here, I'm going to be hosting the seed companies as they present to the venture community. Specifically for me, I'm looking for appropriate consumer investors or consumer and AI investors or people that know this market that would want to come in and be a part of this journey with us.
Yeah, because we haven't even told them about how you monetize this thing besides just selling the mirrors. But we're not going to do that because they need to go look at your GWiz to figure out what's actually going on, because it's much, much better than just selling mirrors for babies.
Absolutely.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Full of double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their GWiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Good day, cyber student. Chinese and Russian intelligence operatives have been detected trying to infiltrate U.S. high schools with disinformation about political figures.
This includes false accusations of taking bribes by officials who have not taken them, claims about election frauds and voting machine infiltration when there is no actual case found, and a wide variety of other false and misleading claims. Their goal is to sow distrust in the democratic process and undermine belief in the American way of life. Your assignment, you should choose to accept it, is to identify five methods that can be used in your high school to counter these foreign disinformation campaigns, determine one that is most likely to work, and prepare a detailed plan for deploying it in your school over the next 30 days. As usual, if anyone on your team should be captured or found out, the school will disavow any knowledge of this assignment or your role in it. This recording will not self-destruct, because in the internet, you really can't get rid of information, ever. Good luck. You'll need it.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. High school students have been detected countering Chinese and Russian disinformation campaigns. A covert agency of unknown sources has apparently broken into radio programs and injected the mission specifics. High school administrators are trying to determine the source of these positive influence operations on student minds to prevent intelligence from seeping into high school curriculum. And that's breaking news on the Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. And now for a little holiday humor. And when I say a little, I mean it. In my opinion, autocorrect can go straight to heel. I don't know if you know this, but someone cracked my password. Now I have to rename my dog. For the tech folks out there, here's one. How do you introduce yourself to a Canadian SMTP server? Hello. Well, that one fell about as flat as an LED screen in a building full of CRTs. What's the scariest thing you can hear in your cubicle? I'm from IT, and I'm here to help you. I could tell you a joke about UDP, but you probably wouldn't get it. Yeah, well, I can tell you a joke about TCP. I guarantee you'll get it, but might take a few tries. The problem with trying to tell an NTP joke is you really have to get the timing perfect. And with a twofer, the best cyber joke of the year is, you got it, Elon Musk. Thank you. Now on to the rest of the show. Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Well, it's the holiday season, so as usual, you can expect holiday scam artists will be trying to ruin the holidays for all of us. There are many such scams out there, and let's just focus on a few. Rapid delivery scams for last-minute shoppers, charity scams to support terrorist groups, and political scams to get you to send money to support your favorite candidate. These scams have the same basic theme. You can do good things by sending them money, except, of course, it's a lie. How do you counter these attempts to exploit your good nature and desire to do good for their bad purposes? When in doubt, check it out. Rapid delivery is often available, but make sure the source is legitimate and one that you trust because they've delivered reliably before. And if it's after the post office last date for reliable delivery, don't bet on it. Charity scams can be largely avoided by only sending to charities that are government-certified nonprofits. You can check it out by looking it up on the state government website of the state they claim to be incorporated in. Or if you don't want to bother, just don't give to charities you don't recognize. And don't trust the links you get in emails. Look up the charity online through your favorite search engine and donate that way. For political scams, the best approach is to support your favorite local political party or candidate directly through their official campaign or party site. Don't be fooled. When in doubt, check it out.
Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET and you press on books.
This segment is called How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it. How do they do that? Fake delivery scams are simple. They advertise express delivery of your presence via email or websites and wait for you to click. They charge you for express delivery but deliver less expensively, or not at all. Charity scams are just as simple to carry out. They advertise for the high publicity thing of the day, perhaps it's the Palestinians or Israel these days, and get you to click. They may deliver nothing to the actual charity, or perhaps they deliver a small percentage, taking the rest as fees. Political scams are the same thing technologically. Come up with a good name for the campaign, Stop the Heel, for example. And depending on who you don't like, they target you for one politician or the other, ask you for a credit card, and take your money, usually again and again, till you stop. How do you know where it actually goes? You don't. And that's how you do that.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, ELN, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence, and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel-to-exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events, and help host online forums, panels, and events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. To join other executives, become a member at ELN3.com today and grow your executive network.
Pete Herzog can best be characterized as a hacker. He's been a hacker since he was young. He's been on both sides of the line between good and evil, if you will call it that. And his career has affected a lot of people, all the more so since he started working on open standards and Hacker High School. Here's Pete.
Let's talk about your history, starting with, you're welcome to tell us where you were born, how you grew up, where you went to school, anything that's relevant to when you got into cyber. So tell us how it started.
Oh, well, getting into cyber was kind of weird. I grew up in New York. I'm originally from Brooklyn. We moved upstate. I ended up going to Syracuse University and then falling back to Utica College, which was still a Syracuse degree. It's just cheaper. And it was smaller, too. It was more personal.
You mean less expensive?
I do. Yes. I guess that's one of the words I get wrong. Yes. Less expensive. Yes. Okay. Man, I see. I'm glad I started off by explaining. I don't do words well. Anyway, so
you're hypersensitive to something irrelevant.
That's why I have an editor when I write. Okay, so what I noticed at school was I found this terminal. So I was let me take a step back. My math grades weren't very good, so they wouldn't let me study computer science because I was on a Pell Grant, which was poor immigrant kids basically, which I was. My parents were not born in the U.S. We were immigrants. I was born in the U.S.
So under the grant, you couldn't study computer science because your grades weren't good enough, which is to say, basically, the requirement is you have to have like a 3.0 or something in order to study that. Because you were able to study
math.
Something else. It wasn't getting kicked out of school, right?
Right. Right. No, I had to have high math grades for computer science, which I did not have. According to the school, which they wouldn't allow me, which meant my grant wouldn't cover it.
Oh, fair enough. You know? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I considered marketing, PR, journalism.
When you use initials on the show, you have to spell them out. So PR is public relations.
Yes.
Sorry, continue.
Journalism is still journalism. Yeah. And,
it's not an abbreviation, although some people would say it's something different, but moving along.
Yeah. And while I was there and I was working in the computer lab, which is something they allowed me to choose where I wanted to work, which you know, was interesting to me. And they had a mainframe and they just started to get PCs. This was 88.
PCs, personal computers.
Right. And as I started and I was working there, at some point I came across the computer lab was in the basement of the library. And in the library one evening, while I was there, I came across a computer that was not part of the mainframe. And it had these books around it, and I was interested. Now, how I got into the library was that the cleaning crew came at 11 p.m. The library closed at like 10, and at 11 came the cleaning crew. But the computer lab was open till midnight, which was in the basement of the library, different entrance and everything. So after I locked up, I went upstairs. I started to go upstairs, and you have to walk by all the vending machines, of course. And there was the cleaning crew. And I saw that they were smoking. So one day while I was there, I hacked. It was the old smoke machines that go cha-chunk, you know, and you pull out the, well, I was able to get around that and push back the lever and the cigarettes would fall out, except I didn't smoke.
Hang on. Just for clarity, the mechanical machines that delivered, in this case, cigarettes, but whatever, the vending machines, if you push on the lever instead of pulling it, when you push, it actually bends. Is that right?
A little bit like that. I had to put my fingers up inside and push a metal piece aside, but in essence, yes.
So I don't know what the technical term, you hacked it.
Yeah, I hacked it. Yes. And
not a bad thing. It can be a bad thing. Like when you take something that, you know, doesn't belong to you, that's called theft. But right. But the mechanism by which you carried out that minor theft was hacking.
Yes, exactly. And believe me,
if you would have done it for something good, like if there was a bottle of water in there and you would have done the same hack, gotten the bottle of water for somebody that was dying of thirst, then even though technically it might be theft, it would still have been for good.
Right, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, so and hacking can be for good or for evil. And it doesn't have to be breaking in. I mean, you could hack the machine to fix it so other people couldn't do that.
That is true, but I did not do that.
I don't want to get a bad, get a bad reputation for hacking just because, you know, you were a minor criminal when you were young.
Well, at the same time, the mechanism was not illegal. What was illegal was obviously having goods that I did not pay for. So, yeah, they're two different things. So hacking was not the crime. The crime was me having goods that I did not pay for, right?
Theft.
So
theft. Yeah.
So now my intention.
Just to be clear, almost everybody that I've ever met that we've talked about it at some point in their life has taken something that they shouldn't have taken. Right? And I'll just give you the classic example of how this works. You're at work and you have a pen or a pencil that you're using from work and you take it home with you and you forget to bring it back to the office. Technically, it belongs to the office. It's not really yours. You know, you took it. So that's a minor theft. Now, you know, give or take, everybody has done this at one time or another in their life, except people that were never in an office that had a pen. So in any case, you got cigarettes from the machine. And what did you do with those cigarettes?
Well, my intention was not to get cigarettes. We just had all these machines, and the cigarette machine was the only one I had figured out so far. I mean, later I figured out the soda machine and things like that. But I was a poor, hungry college student who worked very late past cafeteria hours. So I see this as stealing for my education. Yeah. So I was
stealing for your education or from? Okay. so just to finish that little trope there. So the cleaning crew, the machine. So did you use the cigarettes to bribe the cleaning crew to get into the rest?
I did.
You just would have bought the cigarettes, it would have been okay.
I suppose so, but that would have meant having money or using my laundry change in order to buy cigarettes. You know,
that would be cheating, right?
Because, and actually, who knows how many lives I've saved by taking those cigarettes? You know, I may have saved countless lives. You don't know.
No. I think probably not. But I think, you know, the fundamental issue here is that you were doing it for whatever purposes you were doing it for, but I've done the same thing, not the taking of the cigarettes, although if that's what it took, I probably would have done it. But I was authorized to do it. It was part of what we'll call red teaming at the time, right?
Right.
That is trying to find vulnerabilities in systems and demonstrate them to the people who own them, because when you simply tell them, they don't believe you, but when you demonstrate it, they do.
Exactly. Yes. Right. I did that later. So that was part of my
you were learning job. In your education, you were learning how to red team.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, it gets to what we're talking about in the last segment, right? You know, and I, as I've said on this show before, right, you know, early in my career, people said, you must have been a hacker when you were a kid. And I would say, no. Because, you know, I had, I was geeky and I had a couple of early computers, Sinclair 1K, remember that one? But mostly, I remember being, you know, 6-7 years old, right, in Denver, Colorado at ski swaps, right? Big ski bum kids, right? And going there with my parents and realizing that the logistics of the situation was that I was a certain physical size and I can move through that crowd like butter, right? And, and just the patterns, you know, seeing how the whole system works and breaking it. You know, I as a teen, I did find some things that I did not pay for and read them, but basically, I'm sure illegally got into places I shouldn't have been. That was my thing, you know, exploring the city, you know, and finding out where you can get into. How does that work? How did, you know, if you just walk past, right? A lot of the cliche things, find it does just work. And there's this, so it was always a combination of physical things like doors and tunnels and, you know, passageways and buildings and then people and processes around that. And if you're the kind of mind that likes looking at how all that works, you can realize, you know, I use this, you know, this sort of terminology in my professional work all the time, you know, but it's literally like you stand right there. It's not about the bits and bytes. It's you realizing if you stand right there, count to three right exactly at this time, this will happen, and you can take two steps forward, wait a minute, and then all of a sudden you go through the door. Right? You didn't pick the lock at all. Who knows how the lock works? Who cares?
Yeah. Well, and it may not be illegal. Just because it's not authorized doesn't mean it's illegal. Pretty definitively, stealing the cigarettes and then bribing for entry, that's almost certainly illegal. But again, we're all born as hackers, right? Yeah. We're emotional hackers. We're psychological hackers. We learn how to do things physically, and that's just fine. But I'm trying to think of anything I did that was illegal when I was young. I believe I stole a candy bar from a store at one point, and I was pretty brutally punished for it. And I don't believe I've stolen a candy bar from a store since then.
Well, for all you adults out there, there is a 7-Eleven back when 7-Eleven was new, early 70s. Again, same, 6-7 years old. I could go down to the 7-Eleven by myself with my allowance and get my Commandy comic book. And I didn't have an extra penny for the penny candy, but there was one that was unwrapped in the bowl. So I had rationalized in my head that I wasn't actually stealing because they couldn't actually sell that one. And the lady behind the counter shouted at me in a way that sticks with me, obviously, to this day. So that's kind of a good experience for kids to have. So
yeah. So but I think there's another element here, and that's the justification part.
Right.
And the justification part is what lets you say to yourself, it's okay and I'm okay, even though I did that.
Yep.
And I think there's a big difference, though, in that justification as you sequentially justify more and more things of that sort. And this is the classic escalation, right? The first time at work, you know, I couldn't get the receipt from what I, you know, bought when I was on a trip for the office, and they wouldn't reimburse me because I didn't have the receipt. So I made up a phony receipt for the actual amount I paid, handed it in, and got my just due. At which point you realize that system, aha.
Yeah, you could have had $5 and nobody would notice, and that's $5. Yes. Well, yeah.
Hang on, because the escalation is that now you deserve that, right? You didn't get what you deserve, and now you start to believe you deserve other things. So as that escalates, there are many cases where people ended up in jail where that escalates into the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and in some cases into the millions. So that escalation is something to look out for in yourself, to recognize.
Well, I think in business as well, right? You know, and there's fundamental things, right? And, you know, philosophy has, you know, empirical, measurable impacts in the world. And that, you know, I honestly believe, you know, that there's a bigger schism than there is in politics on that issue right there, right? You know, it's like, You know, can you just know? I mean, Granny Weatherwax, you know, for your, all you Discworld fans out there, you know, you should, we all should, constantly, all of our lives, say, yeah. I mean, you know, when I'm you know, in working groups and everything else, I get the feeling I say this too much, but I state my biases out loud all the time. So I want the answer to be this. But I'm not 100% sure, so somebody, for the love of God, you know, please say you disagree and tell me why. What am I missing, right? You have to be honest about your motivations, because if you don't, one thing leads to another, right? And it just won't work. You know, and this is the, you know, I look up the title, of, you know, you Mark Twain fans may know this is the one-pager story about two little boys, you know, who one's a terrible, rotten little boy and one's this wonderful little boy. And the rotten little boy grows up, marries well, has a happy life, and dies happy. And that's it. You know, you can take your own lesson from that. The lesson I take is, look, just because it works doesn't mean it's a good plan, right? You know, you can look around you and say, well, that person's rich and they've done all these bad things. And it's like, I think, you know, okay, something, everything works if you try hard enough. But how about not doing those things and building something that actually works? That's not a trick.
Well, huh. So, you know, I am constantly in that quandary, right? Because I have to sell things in order to make a living, as do you, as do most people. And when I say that, if you work as an engineer or if you work in a Wendy's as a server, you're selling things to make a living. You're selling the value of Wendy's, the store you're in. You're selling your value as an engineer. And you imagine somehow that that salary is something other than selling, but it's selling. You're constantly selling to your boss, as you pointed out to me, right? Every communication with your boss is an interview. Aha. Uh-huh.
Right.
So we're all selling all the time, but we also, you know, sort of believe that the people who are doing selling are doing something dishonest. And I was brought up that way. I was brought up to see those salespeople as, you know, the used car salesman, you know, who's trying to rip you off or, you know, trying to get more money than they deserve or whatever it is. But I think you should try being a used car salesman. Imagine that's how you had to make your living for a while and see if you don't get good at convincing people to do things. And it doesn't have to be something that's bad for them, right? Because part of that understanding, that fundamental understanding is that you're trying to convince somebody to do something. But if it's something you believe in, then it's not immoral or unethical to do that. Now, maybe you're trying to convince them to go, you know, murder people because you're part of a terrorist cult. Okay. Well, so from our perspective, that'd probably be unethical and immoral. But from their perspective, because of their belief system, they believe that that's the right thing to do.
Well, yeah, to exactly that point, you know, I've said this before it started. I've been saying it since it started, and I'm still waiting. You know, a lot of things bore me to tears waiting for them to happen, but we'll get there on this one. You know, I don't want to see ads unless I actually am interested in getting one of those, right? If I do, if I have an interest in getting one of those, ads are kind of handy, right? At least I'll know, that's right. I saw that three times. There's some company out there that makes at least something like that. At least I can go find them. It saves me time and effort, right? And there's a whole bunch of things that no matter how much you sell them to me, I'm never going to buy them. And, you know, so I just don't waste my time. So the whole targeted marketing thing that it freaks people out so much. Oh my God, they know they're tracking my thing. Look, that's inevitable. I'm not worried about that. I've never been worried about that. But then you have things like Cambridge Analytica, which itself wasn't a bad thing, but it was used, you know, for political purposes to start the disinformation wars effectively using the same technology. You know, classic example of, you know, but I made it for peace and it got used for war. All right, fine. But, you know, we need to get to, you know, the point. I think we are. Right? I think generationally, this is going quite well. You look at the 20-somethings out there. You know, it's the understanding that everybody's complex, right? That it's not as simple as that, right? You know, that, you know, and people aren't, you know, selling. Everybody is selling everything to everybody else all the time. You know, we all have self-interest, but we've gotten to the point, you know, in the Information Security and Analysis Centers, the ISACs and ISAOs, ISAOs, Information Security Analysis Organizations, same thing. We had this history of saying that only the operators of the electric grid or the water system or whatever can be members. They can't even, can be in the room, but the vendors, the people who sell to them can't be in the room. Oh my God, of course not, because people who sell things are evil and they're just going to lie to us. And we're finding, you know, I think we knew then, but we're finding, you know, I think more and more that, no, actually, the vendors are people that build the stuff you use. And yes, they want to stay in business and have a profit and have a job, you know, and have their career work well so they can go home and do their thing. But it's not dishonest. It's just part of it.
It's not just that. The vendors are the ones that fix it.
Right.
So guess what?
I'd often run it for you.
Like, if you're, if you're sharing a problem and you want it fixed, you better have the vendors there. And because if they don't know, they can't fix it.
Oh, they're another, probably your friends because you work with them a lot and you get to know them, you know about their families. It's like, you know, let's take the expectation of, you know, illicit action out. You know, the Michael Frank at Sandia National Labs, you know, wrote this great little essay on why it's more productive just mathematically to be positive than negative. And it came up in a conversation. It's like, if you're not expecting, I'm not expecting the world to die in nuclear flames. It's not going to happen. So there isn't anything about my moment activities in the world that are part of believing that's going to happen. So I'm, you know, I may or may not be contributing to it, but if it does happen, I didn't lose much because at least I didn't waste the time worrying about it. And anyways,
whereas some people out there are worrying about it and that's why it doesn't happen.
Maybe.
Almost certainly there are lots of disasters that don't happen because people worry about it. And if you look at bridges, if you look at engineering is the job in some sense of worrying about it. And that's why we have bridges that don't fall down. And if you've ever seen the cartoon of, you know, bridges without engineers, you'll understand what I'm talking about. And you can probably find it online. Two other points that I thought I would make here. One of them is search versus ads. So recognize that search is tainted by the money paid to get at the top of the search. But
right.
If you're looking for something, you can search for it. And better than pushing an ad at me for something that you don't know whether I want and that the AI doesn't really know whether I want it, because I pseudo-randomly generate sequences of words to push into all these engines so I will get random crap from the AI. Part two, and by the way, creating the automation to do that for you in your browser is something that's now for sale at fakethemout.com. No, it's not really, but it probably will be by the time the show airs, so we better hurry up with that. The other one is novelty. What bothers me about the ads I get is not that they're ads. It's that they're all the same bloody form. It's the same form and format. They're asking me to have graphics show up on my screen. It's all the same square box in the middle of the screen with the same text. I want something interesting. If you're going to sell me something, make it interesting. Make it worthwhile. Make it something sufficiently interesting so that I'm interested in the content that you show me. And then when you tell me about the thing I can buy, that's great. And I see lots of this stuff. This is one of the great things that I see in the advertisement on the internet, these short videos. They have some fabulous stuff that they show you. And I'm like, well, where can I buy one? Oh, darn, it's not out yet. Right? Or oh, it's just a simulation. But that's pretty cool. I'd like to have one of those. So I really think that advertising isn't the problem. It's the lack of creativity in that advertising that's the problem.
Oh, I think like I think about most things, it's mostly growing pains. But, you know, I got to say, because you've got an audience here, because I'm always trying to say this, you know, to cybersecurity people, just to put a thought in their head, right? Because most of the people, particularly the hardcore cybersecurity people I know, do that. You know, like, you know, no, I use random strings so they, you know, the AI can't learn about me and send me ads. I don't. I have specifically through my entire career in cybersecurity, liked to do what everyone's doing. Because if I'm really going to work on the problem, I should really know how it works for everybody, not how it works for the 0.0001% of them who know how to use random word generators to create an atypical, you know, internet experience.
Well, and, you know, we advise you decide, right? So my whole point, that's the saying from Angel to Exit, we advise you decide for our advisory boards. So my point is coming up with good ideas, interesting ideas, thoughtful ways to do things that are different from what other people are doing is worth talking about and suggesting. I don't actually generate those random words at this point in time, but I would really like to see a product that did, because it's just fun, you know? So I enjoy exploring the space.
Well, I like to see, again, it's as we were talking about earlier, maybe in the same segment, right? You know, I like to get a feel for where we're all going together. And just the way ads come in to me is part of that. It's not like I'm sitting here studying and writing a lot of spreadsheets and comparing the numbers. But you like as you're saying, you start to notice things and you start to be able to say in conversation things like, you know, in the last year, there's been this sort of change. Right. And those sort of things tell you more about, you know, how it's all moving along and it's, you know, whatever it is, you know, its evolutionary path, than necessarily always knowing all the details. Now, knowing a lot of the details about parts of it is also very useful. When you put those two together, the micro and the macro, it, you know, your predictions start to have some basis.
All right, well, I predict we're going to move on to the next segment.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Ron Ross from the National Institute of Standards and Technologies is unique among those in the cybersecurity industry in that he has been in charge of the development of federal standards and specifications for cybersecurity since those standards were first started in their development. As such, his work has probably affected more people around the world than any other person in the cybersecurity arena and moved the course of activities in this area forward at the scale of nation states and global corporations. Here's Ron.
So the first thing that we did, this combines artificial intelligence and robotics, because the first thing I had to do is I had to take a couple of two or three courses in robotics to understand how robots actually were built and how they operated. And then I had to take, with my computer science degree, I had to specialize in artificial intelligence, because we had to be able to develop artificial intelligence programs. Largely in those days, they were developed in Lisp and in Prolog. Those were the two big languages back then.
Lisp, by the way, is still here. Language for, yep. Well, there are different names for Lisp anytime we use initials here. So there's lots of irritating stupid parentheses. That's one of the names for Lisp, but that's not the official one, right?
Yeah.
What does Lisp stand for?
You know, it's something to Lisp processing, I believe. Is that, is it in short for it?
All right, but the other one, what was it?
It was Prolog.
Prolog.
Well, so I was lucky to have three excellent professors, and they were all integral to my PhD research. Bob McGee was my dissertation advisor. He's the one that brought the research to the school. And then Neil Rowe, who came from Stanford University, and he ended up, he's still at the Naval Postgraduate School to this day. He is a brilliant.
I know him, and he's probably retired now. He's older than either of us probably, but he still hangs around. Last time I talked to him was about a year or two ago, but yeah.
Yeah, I actually think he's younger than I am, because when I was at the school, when you go to the school as an Army officer, usually you're older than a lot of college students, and he was fairly young back in those days. The other professor that was, I thought, brilliant was Dr. Mike Zyla. And Mike spent quite a few years at the NPS, and he went to Southern California and opened up their graphics processing center there. And Mike was the one who made the trip up to Silicon Graphics and got them to give us those very cutting-edge graphics processing machines. So all of that hardware and of course, the developing the Lisp programs, I had to work on a model that there was actually two parts to my dissertation. One was developing a physical model of how a vehicle would move over the natural terrain, and it would take into consideration, it was called anisotropic navigation, because you're not moving in every direction. You'd move with a different cost. You were either going uphill, downhill, and then you'd have to take into consideration that the overturn considerations, the center of gravity. So there was a lot of...
That's just terrain. How about object avoidance, right? There's a routing problem there, well, too.
Yeah, and you know, so in those days, we wanted to see if we could have the graphical user interface to show how, with all of this model proceeding, if you were looking at it on natural terrain. So the first thing I did is I had to import that database from, it was called the Defense Mapping Agency back in 1985.
Hang on a second. That's a 25-foot resolution, and that's not good enough to do object avoidance. You're going to have to use vision or some other sensor to be able to figure out what's actually in front.
Well, that's exactly right. So what happened, I started with 100-meter resolution, and what we had to do is we had to construct using individual pixels, we had to construct the polygons in the graphics world to simulate what that terrain looked like. I mean, this was getting back to, I mean, if you were to look at today, what kind of tools you have to do all these graphics programs, they didn't have the ability back in those days to simulate clouds or fog or even a you know, developing a glass ball on a surface where you'd have that reflection coming off. That all came later with processing power, which we didn't have back in the early days. So then I was able to import the high res data set, which is 25 yards, you know, per
day. You do a factor of 16, more complexity, more computing power per car, more memory and everything else, right?
Exactly right. And so, your question was right on target. What do you do? I was able to execute a least cost path from point A to point B in that 25 meter resolution, but that's a kind of a macro level pass. And then what happens is the vehicle then starts to move down the road using that algorithm. Now on board on the vehicle, they have a radar and a range finding device. And so the vehicle would send out a signal, and that was what we would define a local area map that we would refine that path. So you're moving from point A to point B. You have that's a global overview, and then locally, you would refine that path plan based on your local information coming back from that radar rangefinder.
Did you have any learning mechanisms in there so that as you went over that path, you could learn about the local terrain and send it back to the database so the next one following, or you wouldn't have to relearn it the next time you went through?
We weren't that sophisticated yet. This was like the first iteration through this whole process. So that's really how we would navigate on the terrain. And of course, the vehicle was moving very slow. I actually went back to Aberdeen Proving Ground, and I saw the initial kind of path planning, the rudimentary path planning for these autonomous vehicles. And Fred, they would move a few feet and they would stop, and the vehicle was processing. Well, I went back to Aberdeen Proving Ground about 10 years later, and I looked at the autonomous vehicles there. They were moving at like 25 or 30 miles an hour now. And I said, I knew what happened. The processing power was what really limited the speed of the vehicle, because now you could compute almost in real time. You were computing as you were running down the road, and you were able to refresh that vehicle's path plan almost in real time. And so it was such a great experience, because I'm seeing over the years what's happened to graphics processors and how the speed of the technology.
And you were worried about how many bytes something takes and how many cycles the CPU time it takes and trying to optimize those algorithms. Now there's so much resource that all this stuff is just like magically better, right? It's horrible to think how hard you worked for every bit, and now it's worth almost.
We probably sound like old codgers, but the one thing I loved about the Mayo Postgraduate School, when you came to school there, they would teach you how computers work from the top all the way down to the hardware. We had to take a couple of electrical engineering courses so we could understand gate technology and hardware registers and all that. And we actually had to build a toy compiler and an interpreter. And we had to actually count the number of bits, because the instruction sets, you didn't have all this memory that is bouncing around today. We had to understand paging and segmentation, and we had to understand everything that an application at that level goes through as it goes through all those levels of decomposition down to that last bit. And I'll tell you that even taking automata theory, which I hated as a student, but I understood the purpose of that course, and a lot of those courses fell by the wayside later because, those courses now were being pushed out because we needed to build more Microsoft engineers.
But the fact is, the knowledge at that level is absolutely central to understanding what's going on across the board.
Especially in computer security, and this is why I enjoyed whenever I post on LinkedIn, I enjoy your comments, because you're one of the few people out there that really understands how this business started. And in fact, I would like to circle back, because as I was developing my program,
let's take a break here, because you said you enjoyed my comments on LinkedIn, and you and like three other people in the world probably actually enjoy this. We're going to take a break.
And of course, I'm trying to think of who the other three people might be.
I hope you're one of them, but probably not.
I am one of them. Yeah, I need to get more LinkedIn.
I think Doug Simmons.
I think Doug Simmons of Cognitive Defense enjoys some of them.
Yeah, I forget where I heard just the other day, you know, it was just woven into something. I think it might have been an Adventure Time. Or anyways, it was the Ted Lasso. I think it's a Ted Lasso reference, right? The unexpected longevity of LinkedIn, right? It's such a terrible website. I'm sorry I said it. I use it. If you don't have an account on it, don't bother contacting me. But it's just the worst app on earth, right?
It's the worst except all the others, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What are you going to do? So, give out business cards? What is this, 1985? You know, to our point, Ron.
Well, so one of the things that impressed me there is this thematic thing where a difference in amount becomes a difference in kind. And I think that's sort of a core principle that we see with the evolution of computing. You know, just that this thing where you move 3 feet and wait a minute and turns into 25 miles an hour. And now we have, you know, automatic self-driving cars running at, you know, 60 or 70 miles an hour with no problem.
The whole DARPA self-driving challenge thing was something I followed all my life. You know, so I first saw that on, you know, when we had three channels and no internet, you know, trying to get these, you know, teams trying to get a car to move across this course in Nevada and, you know, year to year to year. And now here we are, right? So self-driving cars, boats, spaceships that line themselves on boats by themselves.
That's a problem that we knew could be solved. Buck Rogers, you know, the original Buck Rogers system, you know, series from like the 40s or 50s or what might have been the 30s, whatever it was. But, you know, just their spaceships always land, you know, vertically.
On the tails. Yeah.
Just
in the 70s, we used to laugh at that. It's like, oh, I used to think we're going to do that. It's like, oh, actually, that is what we did. Oh, never mind. Don't mind me.
but how long did it take, right? It's almost 100 years before
what you about, actually... I tell you that, you know, kudos to everybody at SpaceX. You know, the Starship 8, the first one, you know, to launch and land itself, more or less, right? Just watching that thing, you know, this is the power of human innovation. It's like, all right, you're dropping a cylinder from space. Maybe if you flip it on its side, that'll cause a lot of air friction. It'll slow it down a lot. So just belly flop this, you know, grain silo. And then at the last minute, flip it up and try to stick the landing. And sometimes you can do it. No, we'll get better at that.
Get to where we can do that every time. But then the question is, you know, because fossil fuel is going to become, well, there's a bunch of issues with fossil fuel, but one of the interesting ones is that if we really go to electrification for most of the common uses of energy, then that fossil fuel will be not only, you know, lower demand, so higher supply, so lower price, but also you'll be able to do lots of stuff with rocketry and those sorts of things because the fuel won't be as expensive. Eventually, though, you know, maybe you need to find some other path. So I like the thing where they launch from a plane in flight because you can get up to 50, 60,000 feet to start. And that gives you a big advantage in not having to consume all that excess energy to go straight up.
Hey, man, if we want to, you know, if you want to tickle my fancy, let's talk space elevators. Now you have energy efficient. Now we're going. That's debating, you know, moon colonization time rates with a buddy on Facebook over the last couple of days. And it's sooner and takes longer than you think, right? Well, people will be living on the moon in next decade and we'll never go back. There'll always be somebody out there. Now, you know, I am not going to live, and you know, I think the youngest people around who have the longest lives today, right, are, you know, your peers who may get a chance to go to the moon sometime. But it'll be a couple hundred years. But you get to the space elevator sort of level in any technology trend, you have to understand, to your first comment, you know, the difference in numbers changes, it becomes a different in kind. When you're not launching 100 pounds, you're launching 100,000 tons an hour. What does that even mean, right?
Well, so the space elevator is an interesting concept, but there are some technical challenges that we may or may not ever solve. I mean, you know, for example, you have to make sure that if somebody accidentally runs into it, or yep, if you get a 9/11 event where somebody decides they're going to run,
knock it out.
Yeah, yep. Try and knock out the space elevator for terrorist purposes or what have you, maybe as a part of the struggle for supremacy on Earth or who knows what. But eventually, that sort of thing has to happen if humanity is going to survive, because we obviously have to get off planet and then out of solar system before the sun goes away, and probably, you know, out of our galaxy before the galaxy collapses or what have you. So, you know, when I say longevity, I'm talking long time frames, but we're actually at the point where humanity has the potential to do that. And no other species on Earth has ever had that potential.
Well, I think it's an interesting way to put it. You know, we live in a time where if you live a long time, you live 100 years, right? Almost anything you can imagine could happen in your lifetime. You know, most of it won't because things take a long time. But given 100 years, if there was, you know, enough motivation, you know, if we really had to get something done in 100 years, you know, move an asteroid, you know, that's actually relatively simple anyways. You know, but there's just not a lot of things that are really out of our grasp. Now, I like to think multi-generational. When I talk about the future, I don't just mean my future, right? My future might be Wednesday. Who knows? But there's no point in, you know, helping these things move along if you can't look at the long trend. You know, it may be 30 years, maybe 70 years, maybe 300 years. But most things that are going to happen are going to happen.
Well, many of them are, right? So this is the science fiction issue, right? That science fiction almost always picks some small subset of the things that are going to change and says, let's push those a long way and everything else stays the same. But it's all changing at the same time and and at a very high rate. So I think, you know, the next version of science fiction is going to be much more comprehensive in terms of all of the things changing. But it becomes less and less science fiction and more just a matter of when.
Right. And right. We're back to my inevitability curves.
Yeah, well, maybe. Yeah. So the other one thing I thought was really good in there is this notion of the full depth of understanding versus complexity. Because as we get more and more complex in the world, it's less and less possible for anybody to understand all of any technology. However, whatever understanding you have at the most, you know, I'll call it the highest level of understanding today, if you're going to be successful, I think you need to be able to track it down to the underlying basis of how it comes to be and how it exists. So you may not be broad in what you do, but in whatever narrow field you're in, if you don't understand it all the way down to the bottom, it's going to be problematic. So that's my hypothesis that you are probably going to disagree with.
I know I can agree with that, right? And you know, it's you know, I like to understand things. You know, in the firewall days, I knew the firewall market as well as anyone on Earth. You know, supply chain security, I'd say the same thing today. That does not mean I know it all. But it means, you know, I have touched bottom in multiple places. You got to go all the way down in the technology and the way it's used and everything else. And if you don't, you can't get that feeling for how it all fits together.
Yeah, you can get a job doing this little fraction of it, but somebody in charge of that has to know it all or else it's just going to be a problem. You know, you're going to fail in ways you didn't anticipate, right? It's that unanticipated future that you're going to face. And then there's the issue of AI and technology, right? Because AI might be, you know, able to answer those questions, not the current makeup stuff AI, but the AI that knows the difference between made up and real, or just, you know, the version of search and summarize that's good enough so it does a good job of summarizing. It's not just making stuff up, it's summarizing. And you can drill down and drill down and drill down, and it'll summarize until it gets right down to the basic information. So maybe that's adequate when you're at a very high level to be able to explore the depth wherever you need to without having to know it all.
Well, and to the point you and I think Ron were both making, right? You know, somebody has to know it all. Now, that doesn't mean that person actually knows it all. It needs to know enough about all of it, right, that they can understand, you know, how it all works together. And you have to, in any grand global venture or whatnot, you know, there'd be lots of people, you know, related to down below or however you want to look at it, you know, that person, assumingly, who knows everything, who know way more than they do about that part of it, right? So there is no understanding all of it, but you can understand all the parts, right?
This is the difference between anything and everything.
Right.
And I think that's also a fundamental when we talk about computer security, right? You may have some privilege that allows you to do anything, but that doesn't necessarily mean it has to allow you to do everything. And exactly. And that has to do with, you know, mitigating of consequence, right? So it's risk disaggregation. Yes, you can learn about anything you want, but once you know about, you know, these eight things, you can't know about the rest of it because that would be too much of an aggregation of your knowledge for the consequences that you're able to then produce. So anything versus everything at the frontier of access control and everything else. All right, we're going to move on.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on The Cyber Show,
It's the end of the year as we know it, and I feel fine. Pete helps Guest Anonymous his way around the world. Ron goes to the NSA. Oops, NIST. Oops, TIS. Oops. Ugh. Rand begins his waltz, man. A pitcher throws a curve, but we catch it. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.